never cease. Will wonders never cease? It's been a most peculiar day. Will wonders never cease? Will wonders never cease? Oh, where was I?
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, July 1st, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a writer. You can see his writings at the Masterworks Broadway blog on Tuesdays, at Critcherland on Fridays, and on the MTI blog throughout the month. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. Michael also writes for many different outlets, such as Arts America and NPR.org. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
With us this morning, we have a special guest who has deigned to get up so early on a Sunday morning and be with us, Sheldon Harnick, who is the amazing talent known world over for shows such as Fiorello and Fiddler on the Roof and She Loves Me and The Apple Tree and The Rothschild, The Mad Woman of Central Park, Cyrano, Wonderful Life, A Christmas Carol, Phantom Tollbooth. The list goes on and on, and we're just so honored to have him here with us this morning. So thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
You have coming up with the New York Musical Theater Festival, the musicals on television, An Afternoon with Sheldon Harnick. It's Saturday, July 28th at 2 o'clock, and it's part of the NIMH Festival. So tell us, how did you get involved with doing an afternoon of talkback?
Well, this came about through a man named Bill Rudman and his partner, Ken Bloom. They had done a tribute to Hugh Martin, a CD called Hugh Martin's Hidden Treasures, and along with it there was a booklet, and they asked me to do an appreciation of Hugh Martin's lyrics. Hugh was a friend, I loved him, so I wrote that. And then Bill Rudman and Ken Bloom said, you know what, we're going to do the same for you. And along with that CD, they've been planning a number of other events, and one of them is this afternoon of TV musicals, and that's how I got involved with it.
And they're going to be playing The Canterville Ghost, is that correct?
The Canterville Ghost and She Loves Me. I'm very curious to see The Canterville Ghost because I haven't seen it since it was first aired.
Wow.
And my memory of it is that Jerry Bach and I wrote a very good score, but that it was cast with a lot of non-singers. So, and one of the singers who was good was a young man from a group called Herman's Hermits. And the other was a wonderful surprise, was Michael Redgrave, who played the ghost. So I'm curious to see how that holds up. I do remember She Loves Me was simply wonderful.
Yeah.
It's funny because I remember very vividly the night the Canterville Ghost was on. I was working in a hotel, and I wasn't able to see it, and I was pretty furious about it. And then, during the time it was on, somebody called up to complain about his air conditioning. I went up, and they had the show on. And I'm telling you, I fiddled with that air conditioning, saying, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, so that I could see as much of the show as I possibly could.
How funny.
Michael,
She Loves Me was kind of amazing because instead of doing the 2.5-hour show, they cut it down for television purposes. They cut it down to about 1 hour and 45 minutes, and it was trimmed so judiciously that when I watched it, I wasn't even aware of the trims. That's how well it was done.
Yeah,
wow.
You know, I haven't seen it since it aired. I think somebody said that some or most of it is on YouTube. I actually haven't had a chance to check it out. But can you remind us what, are there any songs that are cut outright?
I don't remember. I don't think there were. There might have been, but I don't recall.
Yeah, neither do I, but I guess we'll see.
I think maybe second choruses were taken out, things like that. I think they were just trimmed.
It's such a wonderful production. I'll never forget. You know what moment stands out to me to this day, and that's 1978, that's a long time ago, when Amalia walks into the shop for the first time. And George looks at her in a way that you think, I've mentioned this before, he thinks, you can see on his face that he thinks, wow, she is really cute.
I will look. I'll look for that moment. You know, it was they broadcast it, and then, I think it was done around Christmas, and then the following year they did it again, and then our various representatives got greedy, and I think they asked for so much money for a third showing that it was canceled.
That's true.
And hasn't been done since.
Mr. Harnack, the your bio notes that you went to Northwestern in the School of Music in the 40s.
That's right. I thought I was going to be a violinist.
Was
a violinist?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, plays the violin.
I did. Right.
Some might say a fiddle. So Northwestern's long been known as a great music school, and in contemporary times has become known as a great musical theater school. Was it a great musical theater school when you were there?
It was, and one of the reasons I chose to go there was that through a friend, I'd been invited to see their student review long before I went there, the review called The Wamu Show.
Yeah.
And it was so lavish and so professional that I thought, that's the school I want to go to. I want to contribute to that show. And as a matter of fact, during the 4 years that I contributed to it, I think that steered me away from the violin and towards the musical theater.
The WAMU show is have you gone back to WAMU recently? It's taken on, it's become such a large event. I'm wondering if it's always been that large.
It's always been that large, yeah. Wow. It's even from the time I was there in the 40s, it was that big then and that professional then. And as you probably also know, Northwestern usually has a terrific talent pool. When I was there in my year, Paul Lynde and Charlotte Ray were there. Charlotte, Charlotte was the first performer to sing one of my songs in the WAMU show. That's how we met.
Is that the song? Round, round, round is the.
No, I wrote that when I got to New York. I wrote that for her cabaret act. No, I had not been out of the army that long, and the song I wrote was a blues song for a woman who worked in a defense plant. It was called "I've Got Those Gotta Go Home Alone Tonight Blues." It was not a comedy song. It was a heartbreaker.
Oh, is that right? Wow, yeah. What a fact. You may recall every time I see you, I say, you know, there's something I've been meaning to ask you, but now I can't think of what it is. But now I remember what it is, and it involves the apple tree. Now, I saw the apple tree in Boston during the tryout, and I recall it opening with Alan Alda singing a charming song called "I'm a Happy Man." Do you recall this song at all?
Yes, I do. And, Alan was really heartbroken. Mike Nichols called Jerry Robinson at one point to get some advice. And when Robin saw the show, he said, you know, your Adam and Eve sketch has two openings. Adam has one and then Eve has one. He said, and I would cut one. So Mike decided to cut Alan's, and he was heartbroken about it.
How amazing. How amazing to hear you say Mike Nichols called Jerry Robbins in.
It was amazing. Mike was very unsure of himself in terms of musicals at that point. And although all of us kept reassuring him and saying, Mike, you are doing a superb job, he didn't trust himself. Mm-hmm. And he called in Robbins. And Robbins made some notes, but he didn't have too much to say because Mike was doing a superb job.
Now, another question involving Apple Tree involves the song You Are Not Real. Flip, the Bob Dylan-y Marlon Brando-y character sings to Passionella, new heartthrob, who certainly had quite a bosom on her. and I recall a verse of You Are Not Real that had something like this. I went to that theater called Grauman's Chinese, and I don't remember the next line, but I saw handprints and footprints and other prints too. Then I saw two deep holes, and I knew it was you. And the idea that she had put her breast in the cement was hilarious.
I don't remember that, but that is very funny.
Well, it's yours. Take credit. But my point is, when I got the original cast album, it wasn't on there, and I thought, oh, well, Goddard Liebenson wanted to censor it because it's a little on the naughty side. And then when the script came out from Random House, it wasn't in there either. And I was very surprised. But you have no recollection of this lyric.
I have no recollection of the lyric. I have no recollection. It's just so funny. I don't know if we had it. I don't know why we would have cut it. It's
I don't either. Finally on Apple Tree. The other thing, this is more of an observation, but I remember so vividly in Boston, one of the biggest laughs I ever heard in Boston was when in the second section, the Lady and the Tiger section, when they talk about going to Gaul. And we hear, they say that it's divided in three parts. And that audience just laughed like crazy. Now, Boston, of course, is a town where a lot of people studied Latin, and we knew about Caesar's commentaries on the Gallic Wars. But I so vividly remember the revival that was at Studio 54 with Christian Chenoweth.
Oh, it made me want to move to Boston because that line, I love that line, but it does not usually get that kind of response.
Exactly. I mean, it really showed me the difference in education in this country in the last 40-odd years because people just don't study that anymore. But you noticed that too then.
Oh, absolutely. I have studied Latin, as you can tell.
So, well, those are my Apple Tree questions and observations. So now when I see you, I don't have to say, you know, there's something I've been meaning to ask you. So at least that's taken care of.
Tell me about your work with your beginning of your career, the work with the Kingston Trio.
I didn't work with that. I'd written a song, and I was just Orson Bean sang it in John Murray Anderson's Almanac. It was called The Merry Little Minuet, and it was on the cast album. Apparently, the Kingston Trio heard it on the cast album and then just re-recorded it themselves and chose to do practically their own melody. I was delighted that they recorded it, but I was horrified when I heard what they did with the melody. So that's how that happened.
And they dropped a little of the lyric, too. Yeah, so, but as somebody who didn't discover Broadway until I was 15 years old, I had known that Kingston Trio song before I knew there was such a thing as Broadway, and I was astonished to find out that it was a song from a show when I finally did.
Yeah, by the way, last night my wife and I watched a documentary about Harry Belafonte, which is really superb. I think it's called Sing Your Song. It's just extraordinary, and it reminded me that Harry was in John Murray Anderson's Almanac, and not too long after it opened, he called me and said, "Do you mind? Can I record that song, The Merry Minuet? But I want to change the lyrics so they're all about the South." And I gave him permission, and he did.
Wow.
I didn't know that. That's fascinating. Wow. And is he a good lyricist?
They were fine. I don't know how he is generally, but in that song, they were wonderful.
Good. Perfect rhymes, correct accents. That's what we hope for. That would be good.
You mentioned that you wanted to play the violin, and obviously, I think you've spoken over the years a little bit about how you, unlike some other lyricists, you have more than a basic technical knowledge of music. I was wondering how you thought that informed your writing with your partners and with Jerry Bach in particular.
It made it very easy for me to learn the music that they had written. They didn't have to drill it into my head. I could usually sight read it. So it facilitated matters. With Jerry Bach, our technique, the music always came first. Most of the time the music came first. And when I heard it, it was very easy for me to learn it and then begin to write lyrics to it. So that helped. But just my general musicianship also has paid off because I have written two complete scores. One is a show called Dragons, and one I just finished. There was a reading at the York Theater this year based on the Molière play, The Doctor in Spite of Himself. So I am if I say so myself, I'm a very sophisticated musician.
That's great.
A question involving the Rothschilds. Well, I was amazed to hear that "He Tossed a Coin" was written out of town. It seemed to me that this would have been an important building block in the show to begin with. Is there any historical accuracy to "He Tossed a Coin"?
Is there what?
In fact, any historical accuracy?
Absolutely. By the way, while we were out of town, that idea came from Michael Kidd. I loved the idea, and I was able to do some research, and all of the references in there, the historical references, are accurate.
Well, to use
in other words, generally.
In other words,
I'm generally a stickler for accuracy.
So he actually did say Cleopatra may have had this coin, that type of thing, to that degree?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good.
Wow. Again, it's just, you know, to use Peter's word, it's astonishing to me to hear the people, the kind of giants you're mentioning, working with Michael Kidd, Jerry Robbins, Mike Nichol. I mean, we could go on and on. It's just what a time it was.
Well, the guys, they're still around, and 10 years from now, we will look back and say, oh, my God, you know, there's Bobby Lopez, and there's this one, and there's that one.
Oh, that's wonderful for me to say that.
Well, I really appreciate you getting up on Sunday morning to come with, speak with us, Mr. Harnack.
At my age, it's just wonderful to be able to get up any day.
All of us.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you have a wonderful morning and take care.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye. Well, that was a nice treat for us this morning. I hope you enjoyed that as well. Moving on with the rest of our agenda, I want to mention that Peter is on the phone. He's with us from Wichita, Kansas, where he's out seeing 9 to 5. So you might have a little bit of a different sound that you're normally hearing, Peter, but he's on a phone coming to us from his hotel room. And we appreciate Peter doing that. Peter's not working. I guess you are working from 9 to 5 because we started at 9, didn't we?
It's funny you say that because I was thinking while I was hearing these people complain about working 9 to 5, and I thought, you know, I have a feeling I work more than that, you know, because yeah. I always seem to be writing, you know. So I do seem to spend more than 8 hours a day doing what I do, but the fact that I love what I do makes it seem like it's 5 to 9, I guess, you know, only 4 hours long. So it's a good production here. It really is. But what's fascinating to me is that when you rent 9 to 5 now from Music Theater International, they also give you a video clip of Dolly Parton introducing the show and concluding the show. I mean, even to the point where she blocks the show because she says, okay, let me introduce you too. And she makes a gesture. And what's supposed to happen is that two people, you know, a person comes on stage and stands exactly where she tells the person to stand and introduces, gives a little background information, a little backstory on each of the three main characters, the three women who are in the show. So that's kind of fascinating that Dolly Parton is now a part of 9 to 5. If you want her to be, you don't have to use the clip, but it's there if you want to use it. And I didn't expect to see Dolly Parton really have such an important MC role, so to speak, at the beginning of the show and at the end of the show, which she ties things up. And she even sings a little 9 to 5 at the end of the show, too. So there's no question that she is the power behind this show, and more so now in this little clip, which, by the way, I'm also told was used in the national tour of the show. So, you know, they're branding Dolly, no question.
Peter, when I saw 9 to 5 on Broadway, it seemed to me so throwback, dated 80s type of feel. Does it still have that feel to it? And it's funny, we talk about working 9 to 5, where I'm sure that 99% of everybody listening out here works more than 9 to 5.
Sure, good point. Yes, there's no question that it's definitely set in 1979, and there are many period references in the show to ground you there, to make it clear that this is something that doesn't happen today, or certainly not to the degree it happens today, where sexual harassment was just such a part of the daily life that nobody thought much of it. It's nice that things have changed, but I do think that may be one of the reasons why a lot of people didn't respond to the show, because it did seem to remind us of a time we didn't want to be reminded of. That said, I do think that they, here in Wichita, they did a wise idea in setting it in Memphis. It's specifically set in Memphis. When it was done on Broadway, I don't think it was determined where it was set, and we just got the feeling it was a New York show. The sets seem just to suggest New York. And the thing about that's really injurious about that is the fact that the music has a country feel to it. So here were people talking, sounding like New Yorkers, and then suddenly, you know, they broke into song and they sounded like Dolly Parton. I think it was wise to set it in a southern city and have most of the people, not everybody, have southern accents, because some of the people, we get the impression Depression had transplanted, but circumstances brought them down south. And but I think that's a very good idea, and I'm very glad that they did that here. I thought it was smart. But yes, we are talking about a period piece, and it has to be played that way, with the costume suggesting that as well, the fashions of the 70s, so that we can be reminded this is not time, colon, now.
Hmm. So, what brought you out to Wichita?
Well, it's a Music Theater International show, and I love going out around the country and seeing what community theaters, and this is a professional theater and a great theater. Music Theater Wichita is an amazing place. If you've ever been to the Paper Mill Playhouse, it looks like that, only substantially bigger. Paper Mill has 1,200 seats, while here in Wichita there are 2,000 seats, and believe me, many of them are filled. They only run a week. That's about 10,000 people come out to see the shows. And it's amazing to me that this is the thing to do in Wichita. They support this place like crazy. And it's nice, of course, because the word Wichita contains the word cheetah. And so it really should, be a musical theater town. But it really, you know, this is where you go to see, be seen, and entertained. They support people. So, I mean, it's amazing to me how I'll be sitting there and, you know, taking notes in an intermission, you know, and inevitably somebody says, oh, you're a critic? You know, and this conversation starts, and husbands are saying things like, I haven't missed one of their shows since 1984. You know, they take such pride in this as being an extraordinary thing. And it is, because, I mean, many of them are productions they build from the ground up. Yes, there are times when they rent sets from other places, and times that they rent to other places. But nevertheless, this is a house that is, the stage of two is much bigger than the average Broadway stage. So, I mean, and they really fill it with a number of wonderful people, and a lot of people are kids who are just graduating or currently going to such great musical theater schools as CCM or Michigan. In fact, Mark Badama, who directed, teaches at Michigan, and Carnegie Mellon and Oklahoma. These are good schools, and these kids get a lot of good training here. They have 9 days of rehearsal, and then they have about 5 days of performances. I think it's 7 performances that they do, and it really is an astonishing experience under the auspices of Wayne Bryan, who many of us saw in Good News or Rodgers and Hart, an actor who came out here simply to do one show, to direct one show, Where's Charlie, and never left. And he's been here 25 years, and this is really a money-making operation. And who would have thought that Wichita, Kansas would be able to support a theater of this ilk? But to see the smiling faces coming in and smiling faces going out is just amazing to me. And also that they have a wonderful high school program called the Jester Awards, and Michael and I saw two of the people who competed on Monday night, right, Michael?
Yes.
Because that was an amazing experience as well, seeing the National High School Music Theater Awards, which is something where kids come from around the country and compete for a $10,000 prize. One boy, one girl wins. And Michael, tell me your perceptions of the other night there.
Well, it's great. I've seen, I think, every one.
Have you? This is my first time. Oh, okay.
Yes, I know it was your first time, and I knew you would love it, so I'm glad you got there. And, you know, there's so much interest in this kind of thing lately. I guess combination of high school musical and Glee.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And Glee,
yeah.
Because I know there's a... maybe, I don't know if you know, there's a film documentary called Most Valuable Player that actually someone I knew years ago produced. And that is about one of the regional competitions for the National High School Musical Theater Awards. I forget which one. And that was released a year or two ago, and I've seen it, and it's absolutely wonderful. And now for the past 4 years, these national awards have been held in New York. And then also now we read that this year's awards, the ones that Peter and I attended the other night, are the subject of a television documentary that's going to air, I believe, in 3 parts on PBS this fall. And that's, you know, I mean, it's not only the night, the culmination night that Peter and I saw, or afternoon, I should say. It's, well, no, it was, I'm sorry, it was the evening. But it's the whole process of the kids auditioning, you know, and performing. What it is people are nominated, high school students are nominated for their performances in shows in their region. So, and then the winners are brought to New York and they spend almost a week here. I think they're based at NYU on the NYU campus, and they study, you know, and they rehearse these medleys that they all do, and plus their individual numbers that the finalists are going to sing. And it's a really incredible thing. So you'll have on stage, you might have like three Teviers from Fiddler on the Roof, and you know, four Conrad Birdies from Bye Bye Birdie, and I have to say, the people who put the medleys together, especially this year, they did an incredible job of kind of
incredible indeed. I mean, I was flabbergasted because, you know, I've gone to cabaret shows where people link two songs together, and they don't seem to be as cogent as the ones we heard here. Because, for example, just one example out of dozens, there was a guy singing "I'm Singing in the Rain," and as soon as he finished singing "In the Rain," we didn't see any rain, grant you, but suddenly there was Albert Peterson singing "Gray Skies Are Going to Clear Up, Put on a Happy Face." They linked them. After Adelaide sang her lament about not getting married, that's right, when Lily Vanessi came in and said, "I hate men." You know, I mean, a direct comment on what Adelaide was just saying. You know, and what amazed me beyond belief was these were orchestrated. Wasn't that something, Michael? I mean,
yes.
Somebody had to put these together, and really, for instruments, and I mean, they were orchestrated. This wasn't just a single piano playing. I mean, and by the way, I don't know, I was sitting in a place where I think I could see the conductor better than you. He was really into this, and he was applauding the kids, and that was really something, too. But what I love most of all, some people out there may know that once upon a time I was a high school teacher, and I worked with the drama club. And there was a high school competition in the Boston area, there still is, and it was a one-act play festival. And when we played for the high school championship, we would go to John Hancock Hall. Now, when the basketball team went for the high school championship, they went to Boston Garden, where the professional Boston Celtics NBA franchise played. They got to go it in the real place where the pros played. And I remember one of my students saying to me, "It's so exciting to see, when I look up to see how much time is left on the clock, to see that I'm using the same clock that Bill Russell and Bob Cousy and these ball players of yore are doing." Yeah, well, why didn't we get to go to the Colonial, the Schubert, or the Wilbur, which were the real professional houses? We had to go to John Hancock Hall, which is a rather sterile auditorium. You know, and that always bothered me. So I was thrilled to see these kids go to the Minskoff Theater, a real theater. A Broadway theater, all of them, 60 kids can say, "I have sung on Broadway." And that is wonderfully exciting to be a teenager and have that experience, to be able to say that. The kids were amazing, and some of them really belied their years. I had to come to the conclusion that some of them had stayed back 5, 6, 7, 8 times because they were just so good at what they were doing. I don't know about you, Michael, but I was convinced the boy who won was going to win when he came out after they had the knockdown to 6-3, was it 3, I guess? Anyway, he came out and he sang the aria from Light in the Piazza in Italian. I said, he's got it. I mean, you know, really, sing in Italian.
Yeah, that's funny you say that. I actually, I'm going to say, I had him kind of pegged from the first when he sang.
Oh, good for you.
When he sang briefly in the one of the mega medleys when he sang from Les Mis, because his voice was so beautiful.
Yes, it was.
The women, it was harder to pick because so many of them were so extraordinary.
Were so good, yeah.
But let's say right away, the winners were Joshua Grosso, who we're discussing now, who represented the Broadway Star of the Future Awards from Tampa, Florida, and Elizabeth Romero, who represented the John Raitt Awards from Fullerton, California. And, you know, aside from everything else, the thing that I remarked on to my friend, and again, I've seen this all 4 years, the poise of these people. I mean, can you imagine if you were a high school? I mean, it's fine to, you know, when I was doing high school shows, you know, I guess I had a lot of confidence when I was doing my high school show. But to then go to New York and be singing, you know, first of all, sing these mega medleys that, you know, that you've just learned on a Broadway stage with all these people,
right,
and have to come in, you know, at a certain point and sing a little bit of a snippet of your show, and then to stand there while, it, you know, while it's narrowed down to six finalists, and then, you know, and then come out in within the next 15 minutes and sing your solo on that same Broadway stage. You know, it just the poise and the maturity and then the nerves that it requires is, I don't know. I don't know if I would have had that at that age.
Sure.
I have to say.
Sure. Yeah. And not one of those kids looked like he was out of place. Not one of the 60, like, oh my God, what am I doing here? I'm overwhelmed. I mean, they were all terrific in
right.
terms of being ready for it. Enthusiastic about it in the best sense of the word. And not even a case of one-upsmanship. I didn't see any of that. It really was a case that everybody was just thrilled to be there and participate. And afterwards, it was interesting because what's really great about the Minskoff, of course, is you have that arcade outside, so it's a nice place for people to meet. And it was so impressive to me how, you know, the cliche is, you're all winners. But, you know, all these kids felt it. The ones I saw afterwards, nobody was in tears, oh, I lost, or nobody was furious with how could they pick him when I was so much better. None of that stuff. I mean, everybody just felt that this was such a bonanza to have been here, and that the odds were, after all, 30-1 that you were going to win anyway. So they were just so pleased by it, and I was just glad to see that good feeling. And I wish that this would happen more, of course, but it's wonderful how kids came from all around the country. In fact, we were talking last night here in Wichita because two of the kids came from here. They have the Jester Awards here. And the young boy who was Nathan Detroit, I don't know if you remember him, Michael, a little peanut of a guy.
Yes.
Right. It was one from here. And the girl who was in Sound of Music and sang Maria's role was from here as well. So, and they're very proud of their kids, you know, for getting there and doing it. But it's just nice to see these kids getting their 8x10 glossies in the program, and that they're that far along, you know, that they have 8x10 glossies. Because I don't know about you, Michael, but I certainly didn't have 8x10 glossies when I was in high school.
No, well, you know, there again, I suppose that in general there's a more people are becoming more professional at an earlier age.
Absolutely, that's right.
You know, but again, yeah, nobody, not a single person, you don't see anyone up there who looks like a deer in the headlights. It just doesn't
happen.
That's
right. Mm-hmm.
And I even, this year, I noticed less of, in past years, I've occasionally felt that somebody seemed a little nervous to the point of maybe not singing their best and, you know, like not quite cracking, but just not,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm,
not having the breath support. But this year I didn't even notice that from anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Just really, it's such a wonderful thing. It really is one of the best things about the theater at the moment that I can think of.
You bet.
I noticed that the Jimmy Awards are a culmination of many regional events.
Right.
So they kind of have a hierarchical structure. So they're not just coming into this thing having not already been through a number of competitions already to reach this level. So perhaps it's a system that helps improve the performances as they go along, because, you know, the best way to improve your performing is to keep performing.
Well, I urge
you. Well, I was the judge in Rochester, ironically enough. I was brought up to
That's
Rochester,
right. You mentioned
York.
That. Yeah.
And I was one of the three people who picked the two who came from Rochester. And it was so funny because John Bolton, who you may remember from Curtains playing Daryl Grady, the critic for the Boston Globe, was one of the judges as well. And he came into the aisle to sit with, he had a seat in the same aisle as I. He said, you know, did we do the right thing? Because, boy, John and Rebecca were so good, too. And I said, this is like the turning point. Whatever choice you make, you doubt. Because really, there were two other kids in Rochester who were fabulous. And, I mean, we had to deliberate long and hard to say which we would give the prize to and who would go on. Because, I mean, really, there was such talent up there, too. So it was really quite nice to see that this is really spreading. And
I urge everyone to watch that three-part PBS when it happens, and I believe it's the fall. And also,
when it comes up, we'll
yeah,
I'm sure we'll talk
we
about
sure
it.
We sure will.
Yeah. Well,
we sure will.
You know, Peter, you talk so much about making that decision in Rochester and how you might have some doubts. Do you ever go back and revisit other Broadway shows? Because I know that Michael started thinking a lot about Harvey in our discussion last week. So,
Michael, is it true what I've heard that you don't think Harvey is so good?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to belabor it, but I do. I really have been thinking about it. And well, first of all, let me get the other stuff out of the way first. It's just so contrived. I mean, you have, first of all, Vida, Elwood's sister, goes to the sanitarium to explain the situation, and she wants her brother committed because her brother thinks he sees this 6-foot white rabbit. And on the basis of that conversation, the doctor throws Vida into a padded cell, basically. Now, you know, I understand that it's there because, I mean, I understand why he does that. It's to make the plot happen. But come on. I mean, to me, that's just, it's so outrageous that he would do that, that I guess I kind of, I really did not respond well to that. And I kept thinking about how unlikely that was. And it distracted me from everything else that happened.
I'll address that issue as I assume that what Mary Chase was doing was essentially saying that craziness is in point of view, that indeed many people think that other people are crazy while other people think they're not crazy. And it really almost is a coin toss in the way that some people judge craziness. So I think that's what's going on there. It may not seem believable to you, but it does bring up the point about how easy it is to make assumptions about people that may not be accurate ones. And I think that's what's going on there.
I suppose that's the point. But if I went down to a sanitarium and told somebody that my sister thought she saw a 6-foot white rabbit, I wouldn't expect that they would throw me into a padded cell.
Well, she does a bad job of explaining, you know, yeah. And I think that's part of it. It is borderline, I'll grant you, but
okay.
It is borderline, but nevertheless, I don't have the problem believing it as much as you do.
Also, at the end of the play, the doctor, the played by Charles Kimbrough, seems to keep doing this turnaround as to whether or not he, you know, wants to, what he believes and what he doesn't believe, and that was very confusing to me. And then there's this thing of they're going to give a medicine to Elwood, which we are told will immediately cure him of his, you know, of his hallucinations and his fantasies. And again, maybe I'm being too literal, but we all know that no medicine works that way. So I don't see why it had to be that contrived. I think she could have come up with something else than having us pretend that there would ever be a medicine that would ever do anything like that.
Well, they do establish it's an experimental medicine, so I guess she feels she was on safe ground there, saying this is the first time it's been used. You know, and
right,
we're just trying it. I mean, so it's not as if she's talking about a medicine that we all know and have used throughout that. But it is possible that there is something that is a panacea. So, and I think that Mary Chase was essentially using that as a possibility that there would be a panacea. So it's not as if she's calling on a drug that we've been using for years and suddenly saying that it works overnight, while indeed we've known from using it ourselves that it doesn't work overnight. So so the experimental drug is something. I guess I'm more willing to go with this than you are, Michael, in terms of in allowing the flight of fancy to take me. I mean, I see this play much more metaphorically than realistically,
and that's why it works
for me.
Yeah, I mean, well, yes. I mean, granted, it's not supposed to be "quote unquote" realistic, but it is. You know, I mean, it's that whole thing where everything has to be grounded in reality, I think, and I guess it's just a question of how much it needs to be. But anyway, as all that aside, the main fatal flaw I think here is the one that Peter, you yourself alluded to, although I guess you obviously don't think it destroys the play, but it's the whole drinking thing. And
the reason is regrettable.
The reason I started to think about it again is I was reading Michael Feingold's review, and he says he calls this play the most likable defense of heavy drinking ever written. And then he says that Elwood is a realist who has taken leave of reality. His alcoholism has put him in touch with the alternative world of the supernatural, courtesy of his boon companion Harvey, the unseen titled character. And later he says Jim Parsons sweet-natured and discreet, makes an excellent Elwood. I wish he could add just the faintest touch of the tipsy lewdness that made Art Carney's performance in the 50s TV version such a delight. So again, I mean, I don't see what you are supposed to take away from the fact that it's constantly mentioned how much Elwood is drinking. If it's supposed to be...
You know, I'm going to cite something in there, though, that I wonder about, and that is the fact that there's a moment in the play where Mrs. Chumley looks in the encyclopedia to find out what a puka is, and she doesn't wind up following through because she has a social engagement she has to get to. But then Wilson, the big lug who works in the sanitarium and
right.
is essentially the strong arm, looks and starts reading. And according to the definition, it says that the puka is befriended by rum pots. And I don't know if that's something that Mary Chase invented, or if indeed in mythologies that puka has have a tendency to visit rum pots. I'm not sure which came first, and if Mary Coyle Chase wrote the character as being a drinker because indeed she found out that there was some sort of association in mythology or whatever between pukas and rum pots. These sentences sound so strange to me. Mythology, puka, rum pots. Anyway, so maybe that's one of the reasons she made him a drinker. But I do wish, as I said before, for those who hadn't heard me before, I do wish that he would go to bars for the companionship and not for the liquor, and that he would like order a ginger ale, and that would be enough for him. That would solve this problem for me, and I think the play would be so much better if he were a non-drinker. Granted, we never ever see him drunk. And by the way, I watched that Art Carney video and I just recently, and I don't quite see him as tipsy. That didn't occur to me. I think he's very gentle. It's a very different performance from the one that James Cagney gives in the movie. James Stewart gives in the movie. James Cagney would have been great. Anyway, it's a very different interview. I've been writing about George M. a lot for Tuesday because that's his birthday, so James Cagney is on my mind. It's a very gentle performance, and while this is not commercially available, somebody was good enough to give me a copy of it. It really had a good cast, this 1958 cast, because Marion Lorne, if you remember her from the Gary Moore Show and Bewitched, played Vita, and of course she was great as being dithery, and she would, Michael, be more likely to be locked up than Jessica Hecht. Charlotte Ray, who we mentioned earlier, played Myrtle May, and that was a lot of fun as well. Larry Blyden played the Doctor, and Fred Gwynne came in at the end as the cab driver, and Jack Weston was Wilson, so it was a really nice cast.
That's a great job.
And Art Carney, who, after all, you know, the nation knew as a Sewell worker from that Honeymooners, really became a very different person here and a very calm and loving influence. I didn't see him as tipsy.
Tipsy lewdness, according to Feingold.
And I'm not sure if he's relying on his memory from 1958 or if he has a video of this too. Mm. That's not impossible, of course.
Right.
But I didn't quite see it that way. That's one thing I cannot defend in Harvey. Guilty as charged. The drinking certainly makes it seem like that's what's motivating him more than anything else to see this white rabbit. And that's not what should be happening. He should be seeing this white rabbit because he has allowed his imagination to soar. And that's what really has to happen in Harvey.
Yeah, you know, and thank you for discussing it again, because I really have been thinking a lot about it. But I compared the play to, of all things, The Iceman Cometh, only in the sense of
the fact that
people... And there is some of that, but I was thinking really it's more in line with that whole rash of entertainments that came, I guess, mostly afterwards. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest,
mm-hmm.
King of Hearts,
sure.
Man of La Mancha... Anyone
sure.
Can Whistle, which are basically
sure.
all about the fact that maybe the crazy people are maybe the more sane ones or the more admirable ones, and who's crazy and who's not. That I think is a very interesting question that all of these things deal with. And I just object to the fact that yes, that she she seems to be, Mary Chase, reducing it to the cheap joke of that he's a drunk. I don't know about you, but the night the performance I went, whenever he would say something, whenever Jim Parsons as Elwood would say something like, well, let's go down to the bar and have a few, people would go, ho, 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 you know. So it's like, oh, the drunk guy sees a white rabbit instead of seeing a pink elephant, you know.
Sure.
So I do think, so I guess I think to me that alone I would describe as almost a fatal flaw. But
well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned those other properties because I'm one of the people who was of the thousands that went to Central Square in Cambridge in 1971 to see King of Hearts, and we kept that movie in Boston for 7 years.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
It became we're the ones who really made that picture become famous. It was released in 67. It didn't make any type of murmur. Suddenly it showed up at this theater, and word of mouth just spread among college students about how much we love this picture. And to this day, I'll stand behind King of Hearts as being, I'm not afraid to say this, and this will turn off a lot of people, a masterpiece. I think it does what it sets out to do extraordinarily well. That said, I've never responded to Man of La Mancha. You know, I don't believe the Man of La Mancha business at all. That he's just an optimist. I think he is genuinely crazy. I think he takes optimism too far. I mean, by the time he gets to the point where he sees a barber's helmet and thinks that it's a golden bowl or whatever it is, I mean, I've totally lost patience with him.
Right.
So this obviously, the reason I bring up both of these properties is to say sometimes these things work for us and sometimes they don't, and there's a little line that obviously we all find that these properties can cross or we feel they cross, and the drinking does it for you, Michael, and I understand that.
Yes.
There's just so much else in the play that works for me that I am willing to overlook it, though very reluctantly.
Gotcha.
I mean, I cannot even disagree with the words you choose when you say fatal flaw.
Right.
I wish I could, but I can't defend it.
All right, so we only have a few minutes left. Michael needs to head out to go see Sweeney Todd with William Michaels.
Yes,
and it's terrific.
Yeah, maybe we can talk about it next week.
We can talk about it next week. I just want to throw in some... Michael, do you need to go now, or do you want to stick around for some news? We just have some headlines to cover.
Yeah, I have a few minutes.
All right. We have closing today is Superstar and the Lions is closing, and the cast of The Best Man is changing today. So that'll be happening. Today is the last day for Superstar and the Lions. Also in the news, Cher announced plans to write and star in a Broadway musical about her life. Michael?
Well, she didn't quite say she'd be in it. She said she might, right?
Right. I think she left it open like Streisand does.
Of course, Cher has already been on Broadway many moons ago when she did that play Come Back to the Fine and Dine, Jimmy Dean, which had a really good cast. Karen Black was in it too. Who's the other lady, Michael? Do you remember? It was
I have a friend who saw that and it talks about it to this day. He just loved it.
I don't know.
Really, it's a fascinating property, and I think it really has one of the best first acts I've ever seen.
Wow.
I'll grant you the other two acts, and as I recall, it was a three-act play. The other two acts didn't quite measure up, but the first act is sensational, and it was nice for Cher to come to Broadway. And you would think with Cher and Karen Black, and really somebody else terrific too, though I can't quite, maybe, was it Sandy Dennis, maybe? That's starting to ring a bell. Anyway, you would think that this would be a box office sensation. It really died in no time at all. The reviews were terrible, and even when the reviews were terrible, I thought, well, it's not going to matter because people are going to come and see Cher. Just as back in 1963, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward opened in a play called Baby Wanna Kiss that got six pans from six daily critics. There were six papers then, and it sold out every performance. They did it as long as they wanted to, and there was never an empty seat. I thought that was going to happen with Come Back to the Five and Dime, but it didn't. We can't give Cher a Theater World Award if she comes back in her own show because she's already made her Broadway debut.
Also, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the Tony Awards In Memoriam section, and we linked to it in the show notes here. And I got a handful of emails starting in the middle of that week that the video had been pulled from YouTube. And I put out some feelers, And I never got any response from either the Tony Awards or the Wing or the, because it was posted by the Tony. It wasn't like posted by a fan. It was posted by the Tony Awards.
Right, right.
And it got pulled. And if you've noticed, all the Tony Awards stuff has been pulled from YouTube.
Is that right?
But I never heard from anybody. But I see an article in Playbill that says the Tony Awards now available on iTunes for download.
Oh, I see.
So,
the least they could have done was left up the memorial segment, since they chose not to show it on to the people watching at home.
And because they chose not to show it to people at home, I wonder if it's on the iTunes download.
Maybe not.
Yeah, good point. Somebody in all that chat mentioned that when Robert Preston died, there was a 12-minute tribute.
Yes.
To Robert Preston on the and look how times have changed. That you can't even get 4 seconds worth of attention paid to each person who died. Yeah. So really, that's amazing to me. 12 minutes. So pretty impressive.
So
and well deserved.
I'm going to purchase the Tony Awards iTunes download to go through it, and I'll let everybody know next week. If it's worth purchasing or not. I think it's a terrible business idea to pull this stuff off of YouTube and charge for this, because if fewer and fewer people watch it live on CBS or on a network television station every year, a small percentage of people are going to purchase it off of iTunes.
Tiny percentage.
To grow the audience, you make it available for free on YouTube or Facebook or various other places that you can make it available for free to grow the audience. This is just a stupid business idea to charge for this.
Yeah.
All right. Next is Nathan Lane's return to Broadway in The Nance. He is coming back in Douglas Carter Beane's play, which is interesting, because also this week we heard the news that Nathan Lane is joining the television series The Good Wife, which shoots here in New York, along with Kristen Chenoweth as well, is joining The Good Wife and Maura Tierney in reoccurring roles on The Good Wife. And The Good Wife is, I think, a very good drama that's on CBS, I believe. It's about lawyers and things like that. But Nathan Lane and Kristen Chenoweth joining that, and Nathan Lane in The Nance on Broadway. So what do you guys think?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see if Nathan Lane is going to be appreciated by the Tony Committee, because his last few times out, he has not been recognized whatsoever, be it for the Addams Family, be it for November, be it for Butley. It's adding up. I'm waiting for Godot. I mean, it's adding up now, you know, that the Tonys are taking Nathan Lane for granted, apparently, and we'll see if that changes next May.
You know who appreciates Nathan Lane and doesn't take him for granted?
Nathan Lane?
His banker.
And his agent.
Yeah, exactly.
Just briefly, I thought actually one of the, you know, I always find Nathan Lane just as entertaining off stage as on, the things that he says. And one thing he said was that the reason that he is not coming to Broadway with The Iceman Cometh, the acclaimed production that he's been doing in Chicago with Brian Dennehy, was that I guess they said that the economics just wouldn't work for Broadway. And if they had to do a Broadway schedule of that play, that he and Dennehy would be dead.
Yeah.
So that, I just found that interesting.
You bring that up, that Iceman is not cometh.
Right. Does not cometh.
does not cometh. And that was announced this week as well, which I would have thought it was almost a shoo-in that they would have brought it from the Goodman in Chicago to Broadway, but I guess that they are not going to bring it. Also in the news is the sad passing of Nora Ephron. It's, you know, what do you say about somebody who had such life in her all the time? I'd seen an interview.
Yeah.
I saw an interview with her the other night. That was, I think, less than a year old, and there was not a hint that she was sick from this interview. She had, she just had a light so deep in her soul that shone out.
I agree with that entirely. By the way, she was also the basis of a hit Broadway play back in the early 60s called Take Her, She's Mine, which was written by her parents, Phoebe and Henry Efron. They were Hollywood writers and Broadway writers. In fact, I believe they adapted the movie of Carousel.
Correct.
They did the screenplay. But anyway, they had this daughter named Nora, who was a very nice kid when she was going to high school, then went to college and totally changed the way many of us did when we went to college. You know, being away from home, suddenly she's involved with sit-ins and protests, and it's all about driving her parents crazy. And that's who they based it on Nora, was their experiences with Nora. And the play was a hit. It was produced by, of all people, somebody you don't associate with some producing plays, Harold S. Prince, as he was known in those days. It ran for a year. Elizabeth Ashley won a Tony Award for playing essentially Nora Ephron. It became a Hollywood movie, and with Jimmy Stewart, not Jimmy Cagney. And what was so interesting, too, is that at one point he complains. He calls his wife at home and says, "You won't believe, they're protesting about the Berlin Wall. They're protesting about fluoride in water. They're protesting about civil rights for blacks." You know, so, and everything that he mentions turned out to turn around, and it really brought up the fact that that generation really did make a lot of things happen. They weren't just wasting time.
Right.
And it's really fascinating to look at that movie and see it in that context. So Nora Ephron really was the inspiration for a hit Broadway comedy and a hit movie, in fact, back in 1963. So we have Nora to thank for that play as well.
Well, you'll be happy to know that at least one of the obits that I read made mention of that.
Did it? Oh, yes. I didn't see any.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Oh, good.
And the thing I like to say about Nora Ephron is that I went to see Love, Loss, and What I Wore, in which she had a major, major hand with her sister Delia.
Sure.
And that was one of those cases where, you know, I'm not the target audience for that play.
Sure, indeed. Right.
And neither was the friend I brought with me, but it just was so wonderful. Did you ever see it, Peter?
Yeah, indeed. I agree with you.
Yeah.
Not the target audience, and I was amazed how entertained I was, given the fact that I wasn't the target audience.
Because basically, you know, I mean, not to get into it, but it's really all about humanity, and people are really a lot more the same than we think we are different.
And
you know, men and women, straight and gay, old and young, so that's, I'm glad that she had that wonderful piece as one of her last accomplishments, because I think has a tremendous life all over the country and will continue to be done. And
sure.
It's a beautiful piece.
All right, moving on. We have also news that Alec Baldwin is going to star in Orphans. Orphans coming back to Broadway in 2013. This is interesting. And we should also congratulate Alec Baldwin for his marriage yesterday in New York City.
Oh, did he? Who did he marry?
He married a yoga instructor who's 20-something or something like that. Made my wife very upset. I don't know if she was upset because she wanted to marry Alec Baldwin or...
herself, right.
I don't get that. Okay. So, Orphans is coming back, and I am so excited about this because I've not seen a good production of Orphans. So,
yes, and he's playing a different role that we should mention than he played the first time.
Yeah. It was a little bit before my time. When was that originally? Was that in the...
82? Something like that?
Yeah.
I may be wrong, but...
Yeah.
That seems right.
Away. Yeah, seems right.
Certainly around there.
I am terribly, terribly remiss because I was so overwhelmed with talking to Mr. Harnick before on the phone that I wanted to ask him about The Fiddler up in the Berkshires at the Barrington Stage Company, which has been getting very good reviews.
Oh, right.
So if any of the listeners out there are able to get up to Barrington Stage and give us a report on Fiddler, please, you know, give us a call, leave us a voicemail, or send us an email. Maybe we'll have you as a guest on to talk about The Fiddler up there. Both of you guys, you're not going to go see that, are you?
I have a book too, so I'm trying to. And here I am in Wichita, but I mean, I'm trying to really keep travel to a minimum until I get the book done. But ironically enough, Fiddler came to New Brunswick, New Jersey, in a touring company this past February, and I went to see it. And I wrote about it for MTI and talking about what really surprised me, that it was such a packed house, that there was such interest. This is about a 1,500-seat theater, and I mean, I expected to go in and see 300 people because I felt that everybody's seen Fiddler, but no, everybody hasn't, or at least everybody wanted to go back again. So anyway, I wrote the piece, and Sheldon wrote me and said, I loved your piece, especially where you said packed house. So those are his favorite words.
Is Mr. Harnack an emailer?
He's been. He answers mine. Yeah. he's been good to me. I mean, so.
Fiddler on the Roof is directed by, directed and choreographed by Gary John LaRosa, who is a longtime friend of mine. He directed me in a show a number of years ago. My God, 20 years ago. And Gary John has been doing, you know, Fiddler forever. You know, he's been in a bunch of national tours. He's directed it a number of times. And looks like this is a very, very positive production that's happening out there.
Great.
We talked about The Iceman Cometh. So that was about the list of my things to talk about this week. Anything
We're
coming up for
date.
You guys?
What am I saying?
Guys, have Into the Woods coming up soon?
It won't be long now.
Fairly soon, yeah.
I haven't gone to the new Lincoln Center Theater yet, so I'm going on Wednesday. Uh-huh. Have you been, Michael?
No, but I have tickets for that, too. I hear the theater itself is, and the whole layout of the whole roof that they've redone there on top of the Beaumont is just beautiful. And so
wonderful.
Looking forward to that as much as the show, which is supposed to be
really
excellent. Slow Girl, it's a two-hander with Shelto Ivanek, one of my favorite actors of all time. You know, I'm really looking forward to that. I'm going back to see, as I mentioned, Max von Essen as Che and Evita.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this is on topic or not, but for those interested, this coming Monday, well, tomorrow or today, depending on when you hear it, they're showing The Wizard of Oz in Bryant Park.
Always fun.
And I'll never forget seeing it there the first time. It was really one of the amazing experiences of my life. I mean, you've got, what is it, like 10,000 people, you know, sitting there.
There's probably people who are staked out with blankets already. That's a land grab if you've ever seen it, you know.
Well, actually, yeah, no, they're not. That's why it is a land grab. They literally they shoo people off of the lawn for, you know, at a certain point while they kind of set it up, and you see people standing on all sides of the park with these blankets in their hands, like, you know, like getting ready to sprint out onto the, and then they say go, everybody runs out.
This is not Occupy Bryant Park.
Right. One of my readers says that you cannot go 48 hours without hearing a reference to The Wizard of Oz, and this starts the clock again for me. Though, ironically enough, I've heard a great many references to The Wizard of Oz in the last 24 hours because I'm in Kansas.
Wichita, you're in Wichita, Kansas, Peter.
I have a feeling I am in Kansas. What?
The Music Theater of Wichita. You know, they are a self-producing organization. They don't bring in national tours, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. No.
But will they do a production of End of the Rainbow, perhaps?
I don't think so. you have to be awfully good to be able to play that part. The woman
Maybe
is playing
can,
on Broadway
they,
now.
They can guest. They can guest star in somebody, couldn't they? Perhaps, you know, Christine Baranski.
Well, she'd have to be awfully good to be as good as Tracy Bennett. Michael is being uncharacteristically
strangely silent.
Yes, right. I guess that's where we should end. Yes, all right. So at the end of the rainbow, the end of the conversation.
Yes, Peter. You know, working on your book, I remember when I was in grad school that the thing to do was when we really needed to study and buckle down and do work, we would get a hotel room and go somewhere else because it would be no distractions. So maybe you could finish up a chapter or two of your book in your hotel room this morning?
I had a 3.5-hour layover yesterday, not layover, delay, and I did my chapter on Follies while I was waiting. So,
excellent.
Because, alas, that was a Tony loser. So,
all right. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantiere, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The mama, the mama, tradition, the mama. At 3 I started Hebrew school, at 10 I learned a trade. I hear they picked a bride for me, I hope she's pretty. The sons, the sons, tradition, the sons, the sons, tradition. The daughters, the daughters, tradition.
Day and night, mass scribble, father's letter, David's feet, a wife as she holds it, saying, and it's not a man of choice, says the right, as master of the house, the mother, the mother,
the papa's great, she's a papa, the mama,
the son,
tradition, the papa.
Circle of our village, we've always had our special types. For instance, Yenta, the matchmaker.
Avram, Avram, I have a perfect match for your son, a wonderful girl.
Who is it?
Rachel, the shoemaker's daughter.
Rachel? But she can hardly see. She's almost blind.
Tell the truth, Avram, is your son so much to look at? The way she sees and the way he looks, it's a perfect match.
And Reb Nachum, the beggar.
Alms for the poor, alms for the poor.
Here, Reb Nachum, is one kopeck.
One kopeck? Last week you gave me 2 kopecks.
I had a bad week.
So? If you had a bad week, why should I suffer?
And most important, our beloved rabbi.
Rabbi, may I ask you a question?
Certainly, my son.
Is there a proper blessing for the Tsar?
A blessing for the Tsar? Of course. May God bless and keep the Tsar far away from us.
Then there are others in our village. They make a much bigger circle. His honor, the constable. His honor, the priest. His honor, well, many, many others. We don't bother them, and so far they don't bother us. Among ourselves, we get along perfectly well. Of course, there was the time when he sold him a horse, and he delivered a mule. But that's all settled now. Now we all live in simple peace and harmony.
It was a horse.
It was a mule.
It was a horse.
It was a mule.
You would know the difference between a horse and a mule.
Tradition. Tradition. Without our traditions, our lives would be as shaky as a fiddler on the roof.